Thanks everyone for coming out today. Thanks for that standing ovation for me. I don't think it was necessary, but it's very interesting to have Senator Paul with me here today. And as you know, I take a lot of notes with someone of this prominence, but I think I can ad lib and talk with him for the next couple of hours. We just had a talk radio debate about self-serve gas in New Jersey. And I don't want to put you on the record on that because that's a tough state. And it was amazing how many people, in my view, wanted to compromise on this issue of liberty that the senator has become second to none branded with in America. But the book that you'll be receiving, my read on it, is we're seeing in the book something even better to me. We're seeing all these principles in action, not just as a thinker, but Senator Rand Paul as a person, his family life, his upbringing, and how he's come to this position of prominence. And I happen to say that when people read this book, I think we're going to have even a deeper appreciation. So I guess the first question is, who was the genius behind this idea to get past just, you know, the Rand Paul thinker, that's without a doubt, but the person?
Well, the book wouldn't be what it is without my wife's input, and she helped a lot with the book. In fact, she did this right on the heels of completing her own book. She just published a book in the last couple weeks called True and Constant Friends, and she's a great writer. She was an English major in college and wrote for a living, and so she helps to draw things out of me where I might be more nuts and bolts. She's helps to bring a little bit more of a complete picture.
It shows, and quite an opener to the book. When you take us inside the filibuster, I think that was a great choice. And you know, I talk, as you know, 3 hours a day, and you said you like what we do in talk radio. We have to get you to co-host at some point. But 13 hours or so, what was your expectation going into the initial filibuster, and what did you learn from it as far as just tactically in dealing with it?
People are always asking you, are you going to filibuster this or filibuster right. that? It's the most frequent question asked by any of the journalists that are all around the halls of Washington. But to my mind, I think there are few times when something rises to the occasion that is so important that you really have to take a stand on that issue. And I think things that affect your individual rights, your natural liberties, or things that were protected by the Bill of Rights. And so the question, and it's funny, still a lot of people in the media don't completely get this. They think that the debate was really about drones. It was about the Bill of Rights. It was about due process. It was about whether or not when you're accused of a crime that your country could basically off you with a drone.
And that was the question, even on American soil, right here, right in this room, could they do that or not?
And the question goes deeper than that, because there have been times in our history, if you follow our history, when we haven't done the right thing, when bias has entered into things, things that happened in the South for many, many years, things that have happened to religious minorities, people have personal lifestyles. There are all kinds of ways you can be a minority, but these, if you've ever been a minority of any kind in your life, whether it's the color of your skin or the shade of your ideology, for goodness sakes, you want to have a trial, a lawyer, if someone accuses you of a crime, because there's a danger that you could have a systemic bias enter into things and that people could be just... Think of what happened to the Japanese Americans, for instance. That was where we let down our guard and we took away someone's due process. We took away their livelihood and their life and incarcerated them without a trial. That should never, ever happen again. And what worries me is we have people, even some on the Republican side running for office, who say, yeah, when they ask for a judge or they ask for a warrant, just drone them.
Editor's note, E.G., Dom says Lindsey Graham said that. is that when John McCain and maybe Lindsey Graham called you a wacko bird?
We're proud of that. We put that on the back cover. That's on the back cover of the book. So we don't want anybody to forget that. So.
Your mind operates just from the opening question about the filibuster to talk about the one word that comes across that I really enjoy is the outreach part of this. And sadly, a lot of people in the Republican Party still don't seem to get it. You've gotten it, and isn't a lot of it just showing up at places where they, people may not want to hear what you have to say, like Howard University or others, or maybe they did want to hear what you had to say?
Well, it's even more important than that. The Republican Party is a great party for the Second Amendment. Every Lincoln Day dinner, every Reagan Day dinner, everybody supports the Second Amendment. That's great. So do I. But the thing is, some of the other amendments are pretty important, too. I think of, like, the Fourth Amendment is the right to privacy. The Fifth and Sixth Amendment, to me, are sort of the right to justice, to be treating justly, to have what's called due process. The government doesn't take it away without a procedure. You get a lawyer. You get a trial. The Sixth Amendment says you get a jury trial, and it says you get a speedy jury trial. So one of the stories that's really, I think, brought it home to me that we need to be better about the rest of the Bill of Rights is the story was in the New Yorker a couple of months ago about Kalief Browder, 16-year-old kid, black kid from the Bronx, accused of a crime, but put in Rikers Island for 3 years without a trial. Much of it in solitary confinement. He ended up trying to commit suicide. And so when you see people angry in some of our big cities, it's like, this may not be your life, but think how Kalief Browder, think how his friends and his parents now feel about justice. Think, do they think they're being treated fairly? And so what I tell people is, if the Republican Party wants to be a dominant party, they want to win Philadelphia and big cities where we haven't done very well, we need to defend the Sixth Amendment as well as we defend the Second Amendment.
Well, in fact, you... you've recently even talked about a fellow-centric case, Northeast Philadelphia, the civil forfeiture laws, where you have this kid who allegedly, I guess, was dealing marijuana of some sort, and the parents lost their home. The DA, who I'm usually friendly with in Philadelphia, has this widespread policy. We're dealing with potentially millions of dollars. And here in Philadelphia, the cradle of all this stuff, there's not really much of a challenge against that except on talk radio.
Can you imagine? It's called civil asset forfeiture. The government can take your stuff, whatever stuff is, without ever even charging you, but definitely without a conviction. It turns justice on its head. I mean, you're supposed to be innocent in our country until proven guilty. That is a bedrock part of our justice system, and yet they'll take your stuff. The Washington Post did an excellent thing on this over the last 6 months. Most of the people being affected are poor, black, brown, disadvantaged people in our community. And the government comes up and says, you made an unsafe lane change. Do you have any money? And they say, well, yeah, I've got $2,000. I'm going to the dentist. And a lot of us don't understand that, but a lot of people who are poor don't have banks, and they sort of live on the edge, and they've got their $2,000 cash, and they're going to the dentist, and it's just an innocent thing, but they shouldn't have to prove where they got it. The government will sometimes say to the person in the car, they'll say, we'll let you keep $1,000. Of your $2,000, if you'll sign a statement saying that you don't want the other $1,000 back. They will negotiate an extortion on the side of the road. And it is an awful thing. The case here was, I think, Christos Souravelos. They took, it looked to me like a $200,000 home. They barricaded the home and evicted the family. And it's like, wow, this is supposed to be how we're going to have, you know, criminal justice or how we're going to keep families together. Kids sells marijuana, we're going to take the house. And too often than not, the person living or owning the house is grandma, and grandma is the stabilizing force in this family, and the 15-year-old kid who's doing something wrong should be punished in some way, but shouldn't have the house taken
away. Well, that's
away.
A correct position. Any evidence that you have, gut feeling or evidence that you're getting traction, that people are looking at you at least as a Republican versus a place in Philadelphia where it's very, very difficult?
If I were the nominee, we will compete in Philadelphia. It's a long way to being the nominee.
Well, wait a minute, though. That's the newsmaker of the day. What makes you believe that? Because I'm, as you know, in Philadelphia, all my the registration age is 7-1.
Right.
The last two mayoral candidates have both been Democrats till 2 days before they announced they were running for the Republican Party nomination.
Because I'll ask Hillary Clinton, what have you done for criminal justice? Your husband passed all the laws that put a generation of black men in prison. Her husband was responsible for that. She's changing her tune now, but she's changing her tune because people like me have been speaking out against these injustices. I'll also ask her, what's she going to do for poor people in Philadelphia? I have a specific plan that would dramatically lower the taxes for people who live in zip codes of poverty and high unemployment. I would leave $1 billion in Philadelphia over 10 years. What's Hillary Clinton going to do?
To another area that... you challenged Mrs. Clinton, and I saw a great comeback over the weekend. The Jeb Bush question, was Iraq a mistake? You're the only guy, I think, that obviously said that it was on the Republican side. Others are all over the place. And the question was to Mrs. Clinton, now that you've seen what's happened in Iraq, was it the right thing or was it a mistake to abandon it after we were originally there? Which I think was a pretty potent question. What do you make of all this back and forth over the Iraq thing?
I think all the questions are important because and valid because we seem to have recurring topics. You know, it's like we have a strong man and we get rid of the strong man. We get chaos. We have the rise of radical Islam. It's happened repeatedly. It happened in Iraq, happened in Libya. And the question I have for Hillary Clinton is, I think the question to Jeb Bush was a valid question. But shouldn't we ask Hillary Clinton, knowing what she knows now,
right.
would she have been in favor of the invasion of Libya and the toppling of Gaddafi? Because by all objective measures, Libya's a disaster. I mean, I call it a jihadist wonderland. Our ambassador was assassinated. A third of the country pledges allegiance to ISIS. I would call it a failed state. I would say there's a danger that there will be people organizing to attack Americans abroad and at home in Libya now because of the failed state. And we're worse off with Gaddafi gone. Was Gaddafi some great Jeffersonian diplomat? No. But at the same time, we have to, in medicine, in the Hippocratic Oath, we have something that says, first do no harm. It's sort of think before you act. Think of the unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. The unintended consequences of the Iraq war are ISIS. Instability, chaos, and we're more at risk now, and we're having to go back over there because of ISIS. The same thing happened in Libya. Same thing is a question in Syria. Are we better off or worse off with Assad gone? We have people in my party who want to bomb both sides in that war. They want to bomb ISIS and they want to bomb Assad at the same time. And there are 2 million Christians over there who have lived in Syria, some of them since the beginning, since the time of Jesus, and ask them who they would rather have, Assad or ISIS. They'll take Assad in a heartbeat. So the thing is, they'd make Assad great. I mean, he's a guy who gassed his own people. And yet, what happens if we topple him? ISIS will dominate the region.
Do you feel you've been mischaracterizing this, that you would go after ISIS then? You would take action against ISIS?
I would, but I also do it somewhat regrettably in the sense that I wish ISIS weren't strong.
Mm-hmm.
I said a year and a half ago, we had a vote in the Foreign Relations Committee, and they wanted to send arms to the moderate Syrian rebels. And one of the CIA analysts that was looking at this, I loved his comment, he said, well, the only thing moderate about the Syrian rebels is their ability to fight. And that's what's turned out to be true.
Right.
We've given them weapons. The Saudis gave them weapons. The Qataris gave them weapons. We poured 600 tons of weapons in 2013 into there. And what did it do? Pushed back Assad, kept Assad from wiping them out. But who grew in the vacuum? Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and ISIS. When we asked our ambassador, Ambassador Ford, we said, well, will we be giving arms to people who are fighting alongside Al-Qaeda? And he said, it's inevitable that we will make alliances with Al-Qaeda. But that also meant ISIS. And so what happened is ISIS grew stronger because of a bad policy. Once again, though, the same question. It is exactly the same question. Should we depose Assad, a strong man, and what will happen if we do? I think it's pretty clear now that the irony of giving them weapons is we're now back there having to fight our own weapons.
I've told listeners, some in the room know this too, the coincidence. President Obama in maybe the most failed liberal city in the world, Camden, today, on the same day that you're here. One of the principles he's talking about, though, I'm in agreement with, and I think you are, as far as police in the community, and a lot of conservatives are not, is the militarization of police and all that funding and all that exotic stuff.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I see no reason to have a 20-ton mine-resistant ambush protection vehicle in the streets of any city in our country.
Mm-hmm.
See no reason at all for that. When they came to testify before my committee, we discovered that they've handed out 12,000 bayonets. Anybody think we need bayonets in our city? That's ridiculous. We also found that a third of this military surplus is brand new. So my question is, are we taking brand new military equipment, giving it to the police, and then replacing it with brand new equipment that we then buy for the military? Mm-hmm. Is this just some kind of churning? I'm all for giving the police bulletproof vests. We're giving them weapons, ordinary guns, things like that that we can use to defend ourselves. But I think it's not a great idea to show up everywhere in a full military sort of preference like an army. I mean, we wanted to separate and keep the army away from domestic policing. They're supposed to be different.
I wanted people here to hear, too, just in the last couple of days, at least I heard it loud and clear, you would not get rid of the NSA, that President Obama wouldn't either, but you would use it more thoroughly to drill down what it's intended to do versus what it is doing.
Right. My main complaint isn't against spying. We have enemies, and we need to know who will attack us, and some of them are over here. We need to know who they are. My defense is of the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment says that you have to name a person, all right? If I see a warrant, the one Snowden revealed said Verizon on it, I don't know anyone named Mr. Verizon. And I think that's a generalized warrant. This is one of the, you know, John Adams said that this was one of the sparks that led to the American Revolution, was this idea that soldiers could write warrants. We allow that now. They're called national security letters. And under the Patriot Act, an FBI agent can write a warrant. And I play golf with one of mine at home, who's a friend of mine. He's like, "You don't trust me?" And I said, "Yes, I trust you. I would. I really do trust him. I think he's a good person." It's not about whether individual police or police in general are good or FBI mm-hmm. agents in general good. I think almost all of them are good. I would say 99% of police and FBI mm-hmm. agents are good. It's about restricting the law so bias can't enter into it. So you don't have general warrants and you have checks and balances. If the police go to a house and they think a rapist is inside the house and they didn't see him run in, but they want to capture him and they think they're in the house, to get inside the house, they stand on the curb and they call a judge. It's a check and balance, because there was a time in parts of our country where maybe it was a white police officer and they just said, "Well, you know, black men are guilty and we're just going in the houses of black men until we find one we think committed a crime." Mm-hmm. Some of that happened in our country, and so that's why you call a judge, to prevent bias from entering into it. But you also individualize the warrant. If you write a general warrant, the one that says Verizon on it means everybody has Verizon, we can look at all of their records. That to me is a general warrant, goes against the spirit and the letter of the Fourth Amendment. And so when I say I'm not against the NSA, I'm for them going and doing their business in a Fourth Amendment consistent fashion. So for example, the Sonarev boy that was responsible for the bombing. Russians tipped us off, we investigated him. That's probably enough probable cause, even if we couldn't arrest him then, to continue to tell a judge we want to look at his phone calls. If I were the judge and they called me up and say, "The Russians have tipped us off, this is the evidence we have, will you give me permission to look at Sonara's phones?" I'm there. I say,
"Why
yes."
Why didn't they do that? Do you have any sense from hearings and everything
I don't
else?
Know.
What happened?
They also didn't know he went back. I heard this, at least read one report. They didn't know he went back to Chechnya because his name was spelled different on one of the flight manifests. For goodness sakes, after 15 years, have we not figured out there's alternative spelling? I'll bet you there's some software engineer in the crowd here who could come up with the algorithm to figure out alternative spellings of names. But that's not doing good work on the people we have evidence on. Simpson, the most recent terrorist that went to Garland, Texas, they'd already arrested him one time. He spent a short time in jail. My guess is we could spend more time trying to figure out what he's doing and with probable cause and with his name on the warrant. And you can go as deep as you want into the stack. So you can look at who he called and who they called and who they called. Just keep putting a name on a warrant and ask a judge. And people say it takes too long. Make the process better. Judges are available 24 hours a day in Philadelphia to be called. If national security needs that, let's make our judges available 24 hours a day.
I want to pivot a little bit toward the book. I wasn't that surprised, maybe, to know that you compost. I read this pretty thoroughly, and you talk about the environment, you talk about what you've done in your house. And that type of thing with Republicans is another area where Republicans immediately are the enemy of the environment, et cetera. Do you talk about that? And you do talk about it quite a bit in your book.
I think it's unfair that somehow one party got to be the party in favor of the environment and the other party is not. I'm as outdoors as anybody. I love kayaking, hiking, trees. I've planted trees all over my yard. I cultivate my plants. And I don't want anybody trashing the environment. I believe in the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act says you can't dump benzene in the harbor. There should be a law against that, and we should stop that. But what happened over time, and is where it separates us from some on the other side, is over time the Clean Water Act came to mean that dirt was considered to be a pollutant and your backyard was considered to be a stream. And once again, I think we took our eye off what we should be doing, protecting our rivers, harbors, lakes, oceans, air. And we got into harassing people for their backyard. In my other book called Government Bullies, we tell the story of a man who just got out of prison. He spent 10 years in prison for putting clean dirt on his own land to raise the elevation. And it was not the Everglades, all right? It wasn't a river, had no standing water on his property. He went to jail for 10 years. So we went too far on stuff.
Golf handicap?
Average.
But you're a guy that gives up.
I mean, I could beat the president, but that's not saying much.
Oh, okay. That was not set up.
Radio.com.
We take questions from the audience, and boy, this time around, very early on, a lot of people have some great questions for you. Given the passage of House Bill 36, the pain-capable unborn child Protection Act. Do you believe abortion is an issue more properly handled by the states or the federal government under the 14th Amendment?
I think best by the states. Mm-hmm. I think the question that still divides us, and it's a difficult question, is when does life begin? I think we go down all kinds of rabbit holes talking about other stuff, but I'm an ophthalmologist, and I see 1 and 2 pound babies in the neonatal nursery. I look into their eyes to try to prevent a form of blindness that is now preventable. And everybody agrees that that 1 pound baby has rights. If someone were to hurt that 1 pound baby in the neonatal nursery, it's a problem. Right. That baby has rights. But we, I think, somewhat inconsistently say that a 7 pound baby at birth or just before birth has no rights. And so I think these are questions we have to sort out, and we just have to figure out when we agree that life begins. And as we're getting more and more where we're saving babies at, you know, somewhere around 22, 23 weeks, but definitely at 26 weeks, babies are viable and can live, most of the things kind of go out the window. People who want to keep their child, even if they're told they have a health problem and the baby needs to be delivered at 28 weeks, they take steroids for 2 days and they deliver their baby. I don't, you know, there doesn't really seem to be a reason to end the baby's life. Are there extraordinary circumstances? Of course there will be, but I think we get in the weeds too much and we need to sort of talk about, is there something special about life? And I think there is.
Is it something you would talk about in a presidential campaign, or is this, people know that about you, know your history with this, and that's enough said?
You know, the thing is just like with you asking me, I will answer the question as honestly as I can. I didn't run for office because of the social issues. It wasn't what got me to leave my practice. And I ran for office mainly because I became concerned that we were going to destroy the country with debt, that we would borrow so much money that we would just destroy the currency. And I think you can do things gradually, and there's a chance that we have a gradual loss of the value of our currency. We have. We've lost 96% of the value since 1913. Mm-hmm. But there's also a chance that we can get so far overdrawn that we have a calamity. In 2008, we were very close to a calamity. I tell people the definition of a panic is when you've sold all your stock in your retirement fund and now you're thinking, is my money market fund safe? That, to me, is the definition of a panic. And that gets irrational. But that has to do with an over-leveraged system and a system where we've created a lot of wealth, basically not in the old-fashioned way, but through central banking.
When you go across the country, though, are you heartened by the ideas, or it's still up in the air? Because you're an honest guy on this. There are people out there that get this. There's still more people that get how far we've gone with this presidency. And we'll talk about the Constitution and the president. Or is this a dicey area where we're starting to lose and people don't have any sense? We can't continue to spend like this.
The public is light years in front of Washington. I mean, if you want to get to America, you got to go outside the Beltway in Washington.
Right.
Once you get to America, if you ask them about, should the government collect your phone records without a warrant with your name on? Should we have bulk collection of every American's phone records? I think it's probably 60% of Republicans. It's probably 65, 70% of the general public say no. If you ask people, do we have problems at home that we need to fix before we build bridges abroad? Mm-hmm. Should we borrow money from China to send it to Pakistan? I think the vast majority of people will tell you no. In Washington, it's completely the opposite. They love foreign aid. They keep passing it out to everybody, even though we have to borrow it to send it places. They love the idea of spying. The biggest complaint last week was they said, oh, we're not collecting enough records. They were disappointed we're only getting a third of your cell phone records, that they want to get more. And then there's a few of us who want to defend privacy, but I think what I'm trying to do when I talk to people in America outside of Washington is much more popular.
I have a question here as a Catholic school parent. Talk to me about school choice, but I would add to it, do you see this as an issue that gets you entree to be heard on other issues with Latinos, African Americans, and others, who here in Philadelphia there's 40, 45,000 people on the waiting list for charter schools?
Yes. Schools, everybody has access to schools, and that's so much better. We precluded people from going to school, but the schools are not equal. I grew up and went to public schools. I had calculus, physics, anatomy, and physiology. I had a great public school, but not every public school is equal. And I'm guessing there are some in Philadelphia that aren't so good, but I went to one of your best, I think. I went to Boys Latin School and gave a speech about a year ago. And what I like about it is that people just sort of sometimes carelessly think, oh, you know, these people aren't going to learn. You know, it was the story in Stand and Deliver, Jaime Escalante. These were all the children of migrant workers from Mexico. And even the other Hispanic teacher said, these are just the kids of migrant workers. They can't learn. He taught them calculus. and like two-thirds of his kid passed the AP test. You go to Boys Latin. I'm guessing most of these kids come from an impoverished background. They're all going to college. I went to Josephinum, a school for girls in Chicago. Same kind of thing. You see these wonderful successes, and then you wonder, how could anybody be against school choice? How could anybody be against charter schools? We still have no charter schools in Kentucky because the union steadfastly says no to charter schools.
And what's the mechanism? Why can't it happen?
Well, because there's a lock on things. You remember John Stossel did this thing on education in New York, and they have a whole building they call the rubber room building.
Yeah.
People have been inappropriate with kids, people who touch kids and should never be around our kids. Can't fire them, so they put them in a building and pay them every day, and they go year after year to work, not around kids, but are continuing to be paid because the contract is 20-some-odd pages, and you just can't fire anybody. It's like the federal government. You can't fire people who are even misbehaving.
Any Amtrak thoughts, since you apparently didn't come down by Amtrak, given what's up in the air today, had to drive down?
You know, I think it's really sad because I'm on the Amtrak, and I ride it to New York, and we are on it pretty frequently. And it is sad because I'm sure some of the people who lost their lives are people like me who commute between our major cities. And you would think after, you know, having railroads for 75, well, longer than that, but having commercial railroads for probably over 100 years, that we could do a better job somehow. And in order, I think, to prioritize safety, I think you have to run an efficient organization. Safety should be your number one concern, but they've lost money every year they've been in existence. I think we plowed $78 billion into Amtrak. I'm coming up here on the road and seeing the center median. I'm thinking, man, we should sell that. If we could sell that easement to somebody and let a real company for profit put up a fast train, you'd probably get between here and D.C. in 20 minutes.
From the audience, again, you said the main thing you're running on is the debt. That's what fueled it. But, of course, the president and the shredding of the Constitution, the building that we're in, I don't see how any reasonable person of either party would see it differently. What's the temperature across the country around that, and is that really a center point of your campaign now?
You know, I don't know. I tend to talk about like criminal justice all the time. I don't care what the crowd is. I'm talking about it because I feel really strongly about it. And I feel really strongly about, probably even from when I was a kid, about defending the underdog, defending the person against the establishment, against the system. People are treated unfairly by laws. And I think in our country, there are people being treated unfairly. There was a story in Des Moines the other day. I don't know why somebody sends me the Des Moines paper. I get the Des Moines paper all the time. But there was a story of a lady, a middle-aged woman, 30s or 40s, and she's in jail for 15 years. Her mom died. They let her out for 3 hours to see her mom die. Her dad's getting older, and she can't take care of him. She was in a bad relationship. She had a boyfriend, and she was a meth addict, a terrible life. You die from this stuff. It's horrible. There were a couple of guns in the house and some methamphetamine, probably the boyfriend's. I think the story said that. She got 15 years without parole. She'd never, ever been arrested. She was an addict. Let's put an ankle bracelet on her, make her go to rehab, make her go to work, but for goodness sakes, 15 years in prison. Weldon Angelos is a young Hispanic kid, got 55 years in prison for selling $300 worth of marijuana. Timothy Tyler was an LSD addict and selling it to people. He got life in prison. I was in Missouri 2 days ago. There's a young man who was selling marijuana. He's been in jail 21 years and he's there for life. So these are things that I think do resonate no matter what your crowd is. And if your family's perfect and never had any problems, that's fine. But I don't meet many people who are absolutely perfect. You don't know somebody, either kid or cousin or nephew or somebody's friend's kid who got in trouble. Kids get in trouble as when they're younger. And I think that we need to figure out a way to get them back into the, you know, in Ferguson, for every 100 women, there are 60 men. You know, we've decimated these communities, but I think going over the top with incarceration, I think we should figure out a better way.
I love this. I think I know the answer, but I love this question from the audience. Who's your favorite founding father?
Well, we were just asking that. I was walking amidst the founding fathers in the museum, and I think Madison. And I've come to like Madison more and more. And I might have started out more Jefferson, but I think I'm more Madison now because I love a lot of the stuff that's in the Federalist Papers. And Jeff mentioned in the opening the whole idea that power was supposed to be divided between the branches, But then each branch was supposed to have ambition to keep their power. And by pitting ambition against ambition, they were to check and balance each other. And that's a Madisonian concept.
I want to go back to the book a little bit. I pick up little tidbits, and not exactly a fan here in this area. There's a Leitner story, a Christian Leitner story in the book because of Duke and Kentucky and your wife and the whole thing. Would you tell the Christian Leitner story?
Well, we were watching the game. I was in Durham. I was a resident. And so I was at Duke for 7 years, so I kind of became a Duke fan.
Right.
I can't say that in Kentucky very often because UK fans...
Might be difficult here. Well, he made the shot in Philadelphia.
So yeah. Two of my kids go to UK, though, so we're UK, okay. We're UK fans also. But anyway, we're watching the game. That shot's about to come up. Kentucky makes a long three-point shot, and they go ahead by one. 1.4 seconds to go. The phone starts ringing. And this was in the day when you actually had landlines. There was a cord on it. It was attached to it. I didn't know who was calling. So my wife runs to pick it up. By the time she answers... Leitner's shot goes through, and we're all screaming and yelling, and she comes back, and she said they hung up. And it took about 10 years for her brother to admit that it was him calling to give us a hard time about Duke being beaten by Kentucky.
I think the book, when we get it, when we're able to see it and all that, and your wife's encouragement, I think, is just a really good thing. That America, that we know you as a person, that we see more of that. And Leitner's story, hopefully, will play with that. Favorite part of the book for you, either the parts I've been given miserly from the publishers, or what is in the book that you really liked writing about?
Well, one of the things my wife encouraged me to put in the book was writing about, you know, our recent trip to Guatemala and about some of the charity surgery trips. And that was, to me, something, you just don't get something like that in politics. You don't have a day where you just go, oh my goodness, this is so incredible, you know. We had a young man down there, probably about my age, but you get cataracts at a younger age down there because of the sun and being outside all the time. So he was completely blind, couldn't do anything, was led in, was being kept in a church. He lost his wife, he lost 40 pounds, he lost his job, he lost everything basically. But the day after, as we took his patch off just to see him, you know, just the tears streaming down his face, thanking God. And the only time in Washington they ever thank God is when we're gone, all right? So it's different. Politics and medicine are quite a bit different. But I enjoyed, you know, writing about some of medical experiences.
If elected president, what do you see as early on? You talked about the currency. We've talked about what the president has done. What has to be unwound? Because we're at a very difficult point right now, maybe more difficult than any period in history.
We have to quit spending money that we don't have.
How do we do that, though? You're in Washington. Senator's got to be... very difficult. What is it that can be done?
I think there is a possibility that they're incapable.
Yeah.
And if we judge that, and I've been there a couple of years, I'm fairly close to that, to making that judgment. Mm-hmm. There are two reforms you could have, but they're, once again, getting the founders to say we need a few more amendments. I would amend the Constitution to say you can't spend more than comes in every year. And just to make sure that works, I would amend the Constitution to say, look, if two terms is good enough for the president, let's limit all the congressional terms.
This incapability, and you're a guy that talks about Republicans being incapable too. It's how you stay in office.
It's because they get used to doing what they've always done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... when I first got there, I introduced a bill to get rid of $500 billion because we were spending $1 trillion. That was only half of 1 year's deficit I was trying to get rid of. And everybody in Washington was like, oh man, this guy's completely crazy. He's actually putting on paper what he would cut. And they're still giving me a hard time for all the things I would have cut.
Right.
But the thing is I go home and the first person that comes up to me and says, why aren't you willing to balance the whole budget? And what are you going to do about the $18 trillion debt?
Right.
So it's night and day. Regular people get that we just can't spend money we don't have. We bring in $3.3 trillion. How hard would it be just to spend $3.3 trillion? It's a lot of money. We're not talking about no government. Sometime on the other side, they try to say, oh, well, you don't believe in any government. Republicans don't believe in any government. I believe in $3.3 trillion worth. I just don't want to spend money we don't have.
You also, for the record, I'm not Rick Perry here, but I'm not looking at my notes, would get rid of, he turned to your father in the debate, how many departments, again, commerce particularly seems to bother Senator Rand Paul even more than the Department of Education. Why?
Commerce, I think, is a lot of corporate welfare. Okay. And when I talk to a lot of audiences that I'm trying to encourage to listen to the Republican Party, these are audiences that are concerned with poverty. They're also concerned with the safety net. I tell them the God's truth. I won't cut one penny from the safety net till I've cut every penny of corporate welfare.
Time for one more question from the audience. How do you plan to end the war on drugs after you've gotten rid of the $18 trillion in debt? How do you do that?
You know, there are a lot of things that can be done. I have a series of bills to try to make it less of a problem. Get rid of mandatory minimums. Judges should have discretion over the sentences. In California, they passed Proposition 47, and it took minor drug possession felonies, minor sale too probably, and made a misdemeanor. Part of the problem is, and it's like, look, we're Republicans, we're supposed to be the party of family values. Well, we can't be the party of family values if we're locking up all these dads, particularly from minority families. So if you want dads to be at home and you want dads to work and you don't want everybody to be on perpetually stuck in a mire of government assistance, you can't get a job if you've been an ex-felon. It's just almost impossible. So smoking pot, selling some pot, if you don't make it a felony, you make it a misdemeanor, or in some states have decided to go further, but at the very least take the federal penalties and make them misdemeanors. You don't lose your right to vote. You don't lose your opportunity for work. And you'll get fathers back in the family quicker. And I think the sooner the better.
The group of people that your outreach has been most successful with, and I see some of the audience staying with Rand today, are younger people. Do you see that as the real niche group for Republicans to reach, in addition to these others that might be a bit harder?
If Republicans are willing to defend privacy, I think the kids are very much drawn to the fact that their world revolves around their cell phone and communicating with their friends and family through the cell phone. They don't understand why the government would have any reason to look at their phone records.
Parting area, with your indulgence, for your book, a part that I highlighted that really moved me out of the couple chapters I have, you talk about home. You talk about home and a family are a civilizing force. Often people come up to me and lament the loss of family, the brokenness of home. I remind them that some things are outside the realm of government. No amount of government will ever create a home or help mend a broken family. We must turn our gaze from government, look to our families, our ethics, our values, our pastors, and spiritual leaders.
You know, the thing is that we do. We're always complaining about stuff, and we want government to fix everything. One of the stabilizing and civilizing forces is having your kids after you're married. If you look at poverty statistics, it's the number one associated factor with poverty. And you just can't question these statistics. When you start talking about it, people think, oh, you're some kind of prude or something. I don't care what you do. I'm just trying to tell you, tell your kids that if you want to economically succeed, to wait. And someone's got to do that. And I kind of do that, but I can't make anybody. All I can do is exhort, and other people can exhort people to try to understand this. But it's a big problem. In the last couple of decades, we've gone from a society that traditionally waited to have their kids to a society that over half the time doesn't wait to have their kids. But we get stuck, and that's how we're mired in poverty and don't get a chance. And so I think someone needs to talk about it, but there is no law to fix it. You've got to fix it yourselves.
Senator Rand Paul, everyone, today. Thank you, Senator, so much for joining us.